Okay, picture this. A 35-year-old looks healthy, hits your ED. He's just absolutely clutching his upper abdomen. The pain, excruciating, persistent, shooting straight to his back. You glance at the monitor, tachycardic, hypotensive. This guy is acutely ill. So, what's the one lab test you're absolutely reaching for right now? And what diagnosis is flashing in your mind? Today, on 88 Diagnoses, we're doing a deep dive into acute pancreatitis. All right, let's jump straight in. Segment one, rapid rundown. Let's nail the basics. So when we say acute pancreatitis, what are we actually talking about? What's the core definition?
Basically, it's an acute inflammatory process right there in the pancreas. And while that kind of severe upper abdominal pain you described is a huge clue,
Right, the pain is key.
it is, but you can't diagnose it just on pain alone.
Yeah.
You really need biochemical proof from labs, or you need to see those characteristic findings on imaging. It's about confirming that inflammation is happening.
Okay, so we suspect inflammation. How do we classify it? I mean, is all pancreatitis the same, or are there important distinctions we need to make quickly?
Oh, definitely not the same. And knowing the difference is critical. We use the revised Atlanta classification system. It looks at two main things: what the pancreas actually looks like, the morphology, and how sick the patient is, the severity.
Morphology. Tell me more about that.
So morphologically, you've mainly got two types. First, there's interstitial edematous acute pancreatitis. Think of this as the pancreas being really angry and swollen, inflammation of the pancreas and the tissues around it, but without actual tissue death, no necrosis.
Just inflammation and swelling.
Exactly. Then the more serious one is necrotizing acute pancreatitis. Here, the inflammation is so bad it actually causes parts of the pancreatic tissue or the surrounding tissue or both to die. That's necrosis, and it's a whole different ballgame.
Okay, necrosis is bad. And what about the severity classification? Why is that so vital?
Severity directly impacts prognosis and how you manage the patient. It's broken down into three levels. You've got mild acute pancreatitis. Basically, no organ failure, no local or systemic complications. That's the best case scenario.
What's next?
Then there's moderately severe. This is where you might see transient organ failure, meaning it pops up but resolves within 48 hours. Or you have local complications like fluid collections or maybe systemic complications, but crucially, no persistent organ failure.
And the worst category.
That would be severe acute pancreatitis. This is defined by persistent organ failure lasting more than 48 hours. It could involve one organ or multiple, typically respiratory, cardiovascular, or renal systems. We actually use the Marshall score, needing a score of two or more, to objectively define this organ failure, recognizing this is crucial because these patients need the highest level of care.
Got it. That classification is detailed, but you know, when you're in the thick of it, you need something faster, a mental shortcut. Let's talk about the PLI criteria. I like thinking of it as your pancreatitis landing instruction. You need these points to confidently land the diagnosis, right?
Exactly. PLI is your immediate diagnostic framework. So P is for pain, that classic acute onset, persistent, severe epigastric pain, often, like you said, radiating to the back.
Check. What's L?
L is for lipase or amylase. Specifically, you need to see serum lipase or amylase elevated to three times or greater than the upper limit of normal. That three times threshold is key.
And I.
I is for imaging. This means seeing characteristic findings of acute pancreatitis on imaging studies like contrast-enhanced CT, MRI, or even a transabdominal ultrasound sometimes.
Okay, PLI, pain, lipase, amylase, 3x ULN, imaging findings. Now, here's a massive on the words tip, right? If your patient has that classic pain and their lipase or amylase is way up there, more than three times normal.
Then you don't necessarily need the eye. You've met two out of the three criteria. That's enough to make the diagnosis. No need for immediate imaging just to confirm what you already know clinically and biochemically. Saves time, saves resources.
Absolutely, don't overorder.
And that reminds me, I totally remember being on night float, religiously ordering amylase and lipase every single day on my pancreatitis patients. I thought, you know, more data must be better.
We've all been there.
Right. Until my attending gently pointed out on rounds, look, once the diagnosis is made, checking these daily doesn't change a thing about management. It just racks up costs. So yeah, don't be that resident wasting resources once you've got the answer.
Solid advice. Okay, let's pause everyone. Freeze for 10 seconds. What's the single lab test you'd prioritize if you suspect acute pancreatitis and why? Go.
All right, what's the answer?
It's got to be lipase, hands down. Why? Because it rises pretty early, stays elevated much longer than amylase, and it's generally more sensitive, especially in alcoholic pancreatitis where amylase can sometimes be falsely low.
Yeah.
Lipase gives you a better diagnostic window.
Okay, everyone, burn this into your brain. Acute pancreatitis diagnosis requires two out of the three PLI criteria: pain, lipase amylase 3x ULN, or imaging findings. Moving on to segment two, ward wins pearls for practice. We know about the hallmark pain, but what else should we be looking for? In the history, on the physical exam, what are those other clues? Good question. Besides the pain, you'll find that about 90% of these patients have associated nausea and vomiting. It's really common. You might also notice their abdomen seems distended, and when you listen, you hear hypoactive bowel sounds that often points to an ileus, where the bowel motility just slows right down because of the nearby inflammation.
Does the type of pain give any clues?
It definitely can. Sometimes the characteristics of the pain point towards the cause. For example, gallstone pancreatitis often presents with really rapid onset pain, hitting peak intensity in maybe 10-20 minutes, whereas pancreatitis due to alcohol or maybe hereditary causes might have a less abrupt start, maybe more vague, poorly localized pain.
And what about the physical exam? What are we looking for, especially the red flags for severe disease?
Well, epigastric tenderness is almost a given. But what you really need to be vigilant for, especially if you're worried about severe pancreatitis, are signs of systemic problems, things like fever, tachypnea, breathing fast, hypoxemia, low oxygen, and hypotension, low blood pressure.
Any really specific signs?
Yes. Though they're rare, they are critical if you see them. These are the ecchymotic discolorations, bruising. You might see Cullen's sign, which is bruising around the umbilicus, the belly button, or Gray-Turner sign, which is bruising on the flanks, if you see either of those.
That's bad news, right?
Very bad news. It strongly suggests retroperitoneal hemorrhage, often associated with underlying pancreatic necrosis. It's an immediate signal that this is severe bleeding pancreatitis and you need to act fast.
Okay, so we've covered the P for pain in our PLI mnemonic. Let's dive deeper into L for labs. You already mentioned lipase is preferred. Why exactly is lipase considered superior to amylase on the wards?
Right, lipase really is the winner here for a few key reasons. It starts to rise within about 4 to 8 hours after symptoms begin, peaks around 24 hours. But critically, it stays elevated much longer, typically 8 to 14 days.
Compared to amylase.
Compared to amylase, which has a much shorter half-life, only about 10 hours, amylase levels often return to normal within just 3 to 5 days. So lipase gives you a much wider window for diagnosis. This is super important for patients who present late, say more than 24 hours after their pain started. By then, their amylase might actually be normal or near normal, which could mislead you.
And you mentioned sensitivity issues with amylase too.
Exactly. Lipase is generally more sensitive than amylase, especially in alcoholic pancreatitis. In fact, amylase might not even be elevated in up to 20% of alcoholic pancreatitis cases, maybe because the damaged pancreas just can't produce it efficiently anymore. Also, in pancreatitis caused by high triglycerides, amylase can be falsely normal in about 50% of cases due to interference with the lab assay. Lipase doesn't have these same pitfalls.
That's huge. So, on the wards, tip number two, always factor in when the patient presented. If it's more than 24 hours after symptom onset, definitely rely on lipase. Amylase might betray you.
Precisely. And on the wards, tip number three, if you ever, ever spot Cullen's or Gray-Turner sign, remember, periumbilical or flank bruising, even though they're uncommon, your immediate thought must be severe necrotizing pancreatitis with potential bleeding. It's a critical red flag demanding immediate attention and likely escalation of care.
I definitely had a case that hammered this home for me. Patient comes in, awful abdominal pain, classic story. But their amylase, barely elevated. I almost, you know, started thinking about other things. But then I saw the history, heavy alcohol use.
Ah, the key piece of history.
Exactly. So I thought, okay, let's check the lipase. And boom, it was through the roof. That really taught me to trust lipase, especially when alcohol is involved or the amylase just doesn't fit the clinical picture. Definitely a ward win in understanding those lab nuances.
That's a perfect example. Okay, team, quick recall time. Name two distinct conditions that can mimic the symptoms of acute pancreatitis, but usually present with normal amylase and lipase levels. You've got 10 seconds. Go. All right, time's up. What did you come up with?
Hopefully you thought of things like peptic ulcer disease, maybe choledochlorhydriasis or cholangitis, though liver enzymes might be up, or even hepatitis. All can cause pretty bad upper abdominal pain, but typically won't give you those sky-high pancreatic enzymes.
Excellent. Now, burn this into your brain. Lipase reigns supreme over amylase. For diagnosis, it's more sensitive, lasts longer, especially crucial in alcoholics or late presenters. And remember those rare bruises, Cullen's and Gray-Turner, they signal severe bleeding necrosis.
Okay, let's transition to segment three, Case clash diagnostic dilemmas and complications. We got the basics, we know our labs.
Mm-hmm.
But what about those really tricky situations where the diagnosis isn't quite so obvious, or where we absolutely need to rule out other serious causes of acute abdominal pain?
Yeah.
Abdomen's a crowded neighborhood, after all.
Yeah, this is where your clinical reasoning really gets tested. You have to keep a broad differential. For instance, think about peptic ulcer disease. Sure, it causes epigastric pain, but it's often more intermittent, maybe doesn't radiate classically to the back, and crucially, the amylase and lipase should be normal.
What about biliary issues?
Right, like choledocholithiasis, stones of the common bile duct, or cholangitis, infection of the bile ducts. These can cause upper abdominal pain, maybe jaundice, fever.
Mm.
You'll likely see elevated liver enzymes, ALT, AST, bilirubin, ALK, FOS, because of the blockage. But again, the pancreatic enzymes themselves are usually normal. And then there's cholecystitis, gallbladder inflammation, that's typically right upper quadrant pain, maybe a positive Murphy sign on exam. Amylase and lipase can be slightly elevated in cholecystitis, maybe from some local inflammation irritating the pancreas, but they almost never reach that diagnostic threshold of 3 times the upper limit of normal needed for pancreatitis.
Okay, those are important distinctions, but what about the really acute surgical emergencies, like a perforated ulcer or bowel obstruction or ischemia? How do we differentiate those quickly?
Great question. Those are the can't-miss diagnoses. For a perforated viscus, like a ruptured ulcer, think sudden, dramatic onset of severe, generalized abdominal pain. The key here is peritoneal signs. The patient's abdomen will likely be rigid, board-like, with guarding and rebound tenderness. That's very different from the typical localized epigastric tenderness of pancreatitis. And imaging will often show free air under the diaphragm.
Okay, peritoneal signs, think perforation. What about obstruction?
For intestinal obstruction, you're looking for symptoms like significant vomiting, often inability to pass gas or stool, obstipation, and abdominal distension. A CT scan will show dilated loops of bowel, maybe a transition point. Often there's a history of prior abdominal surgery causing adhesions.
And mesenteric ischemia. That one's scary.
Very scary. Mesenteric ischemia classically presents as severe abdominal pain that seems out of proportion to the physical exam findings. The patient is writhing in agony, but their belly might not be that tender initially. You need to look for risk factors like atrial fibrillation or significant atherosclerosis. CT angiography is often needed to confirm it. And lastly, don't forget hepatitis. It can cause right upper quadrant pain, maybe jaundice, but the hallmark is markedly elevated liver transaminases, ASTALT, while amylase and lipase stay normal.
Wow, okay, lots to keep in mind. This brings us nicely to the IHI in our PLI mnemonic imaging. We said it's not always needed for diagnosis, but when does imaging really become crucial in pancreatitis, and what are our options?
Imaging plays several key roles beyond just initial diagnosis. It's vital when the diagnosis is uncertain, when you need to differentiate from those mimics we just discussed, or very importantly, when you suspect complications. Your first go-to, often, is an abdominal ultrasound.
Why ultrasound first?
It's quick, non-invasive, no radiation, and it's excellent for looking for gallstones, which, remember, are the most common cause of pancreatitis. So it helps establish the potential etiology right away. It might also show an enlarged, hypoechoic, darker pancreas, the downside. It can be limited by bowel gas obscuring the view, and it's not great for seeing necrosis or deep fluid collections.
So when do we bring out the big guns, CT and MRI?
Contrast-enhanced CT scan is really the workhorse for assessing the severity of pancreatitis. It's the best way to see the extent of pancreatic necrosis. Necrotic tissue doesn't enhance with contrast, and to identify local complications like pseudocysts or walled-off necrosis. But here's a really important on-the-words tip. For accurately assessing necrosis, you generally want to wait at least 3 days, so 72 hours, after the symptoms started.
Why wait?
Because the necrosis takes time to fully develop and become visible on CT. If you scan too early, you might underestimate the severity. CT is also fantastic for ruling out all those other serious causes of abdominal pain we discussed.
And MRI, when does that come into play?
MRI actually has some advantages. It's potentially more sensitive than CT for diagnosing early acute pancreatitis. And it's excellent for visualizing the pancreatic and bile ducts. And MRCP, magnetic resonance telangiopancreatography, is non-invasive and almost as good as an invasive ERCP for detecting bile duct stones.
Other advantages of MRI?
Big ones are no ionizing radiation, which is great for younger patients or pregnant patients. And the contrast agent used, gadolinium, generally has a lower risk of kidney injury compared to the CT's iodinated contrast. Plus, even with that contrast, an MRI can often identify pancreatic necrosis, which is super helpful in patients with severe renal failure, where you want to avoid contrast altogether. The downsides. MRIs take longer, aren't always readily available, and require more patient cooperation.
Okay, that clarifies the rules. So, another practical on the wards tip. If your pancreatitis patient isn't getting better after, say, 48 to 72 hours of good supportive care fluids, pain control, that's when you should strongly consider getting that abdominal CT. You need to look for complications like necrosis or infected fluid collections that might be driving their poor response. Just remember that 72-hour timing for optimal necrosis assessment.
Absolutely. And one more on the wards tip here. For specific populations, pregnant patients where you want to avoid radiation, patients with severe allergies to CT contrast, or those with significant renal failure, MRI and MRCP if needed, becomes your preferred imaging modality. Remember, non-enhanced MRI can still pick up necrosis and renal failure.
You know, I had a case once, seemed like pancreatitis, pain was mostly right, but something felt off. The guarding was a bit more than I expected for typical pancreatitis. My gut was just screaming that something else was going on.
Trusting that gut feeling.
Totally. We pushed for a CT scan, and sure enough, perforated duodenal ulcer with free air. It really hammered home the point. Keep that differential wide open. Don't get tunnel vision on pancreatitis, even when it seems likely. Sometimes that gut feeling is your brain picking up on subtle clues that don't quite fit the classic picture.
That's a perfect example of why imaging can be critical in differentiating. All right, quick fire question time. What's one major advantage of MRI over CT when you're thinking about early acute pancreatitis or if your patient has renal failure? 10 seconds. Okay, what is it?
Hopefully you landed on either its higher sensitivity for detecting early changes of pancreatitis, the lack of radiation, or the fact that non-enhanced MRI can still identify necrosis in patients with renal failure.
Exactly right. So let's burn this into your brain. Imaging isn't just for the initial diagnosis. It's absolutely crucial for sorting out mimics, figuring out severity, and spotting complications down the line. Think CT for necrosis, but wait 72 hours. And MRI when radiation or contrast is a major concern.
All right, residents, buckle up. It's time to test your diagnostic chops with a rapid-fire case study to pull all this together. Ready?
Let's do it. Here's the setup. A 60-year-old man, history of hypertension, comes into the ED. He's got severe epigastric pain radiating straight to his back. Says it started suddenly right after a big fatty meal. He's nauseous, vomited twice. On exam, heart rate is up, BP is a bit low at 1 in 60. His epigastrium is exquisitely tender to touch. No jaundice, no funny rashes, no bruising on his belly or flanks. Initial labs. White count is 16,000. Hemoglobin 14, creatinine 1.0. His lipase comes back at 800, let's say the upper limit of normal. ULN at your hospital is 100. His amylase is 250 with the same ULN of 100.
Okay, based on just that information, do you have enough to diagnose acute pancreatitis? Think about it, verbalize your reasoning, or jot it down. Go.
All right, what's the verdict? Can we diagnose it?
Yes, absolutely. You've got two out of the three PLI criteria locked down. First, pain. He has the characteristic acute onset, severe epigastric pain radiating to the back, especially after a fatty meal, textbook.
Second, lipase amylase. His lipase is 800. With an upper limit of normal of 100, that's 8 times the upper limit. It clearly smashes the requirement of being greater than 3 times the upper limit of normal. The amylase is also elevated at 2.5 times normal, but the lipase alone seals the deal biochemically.
So PNL are met.
Exactly. Since you have characteristic pain and the required enzyme elevation, you technically don't need imaging right now just to make the diagnosis of acute pancreatitis.
Okay, curveball time. What if his labs were different? Say his lipase was only 250, so 2.5 times normal, and his amylase was 151.5 times normal. But you find out he's a chronic heavy alcohol user. Does that change things? Can you diagnose pancreatitis just based on those lower enzyme levels in an alcoholic?
It's a great clinical question. Even though we know lipase is more sensitive in alcoholics and amylase can be falsely low, you still generally need the lipase or amylase to be greater than 3 times the upper limit of normal to meet the biochemical diagnostic criterion definitively based on labs alone.
So if the enzymes are elevated but not over that 3x threshold,
then the diagnosis becomes uncertain based just on pain and labs. In that scenario, the eye for imaging becomes crucial. You'd absolutely need imaging, likely a CT or MRI, to confirm the presence of pancreatitis changes, and importantly, to rule out other potential causes for his pain, especially given the somewhat ambiguous lab picture. So no, you can't just lower the enzyme threshold because he's an alcoholic. The 3x rule still generally applies for the biochemical criterion.
Good clarification. Okay, branching scenario one, let's go back to the original patient, lipase 800. What if, 24 hours after admission, he suddenly develops shortness of breath, his blood pressure drops again, and his creatinine starts shooting up? What does that signify?
Alarm bells should be ringing. New onset shortness of breath points to respiratory compromise. Hyotension indicates cardiovascular instability. Rising creatinine signals acute kidney injury. He's developing persistent organ failure involving multiple systems, which means he is rapidly progressing from likely mild or moderately severe pancreatitis to severe acute pancreatitis based on the Atlanta classification. You'd immediately need to assess him using the modified Marshall score to quantify the organ dysfunction and significantly escalate his level of care, likely ICU admission, aggressive resuscitation, close monitoring. This is a major downturn.
Okay, branching scenario two. Fast forward a week, our original patient is still in the hospital. He's still having quite a bit of pain, maybe running low-grade fevers, just generally not improving despite getting good standard supportive care, fluids, pain meds, bowel rest. What imaging study would you order now and why?
At this point, a week in with failure to improve, you absolutely need a contrast-enhanced abdominal CT scan. Why now? Because enough time has passed, well over the 72-hour mark, for complications like pancreatic necrosis or peripancreatic fluid collections, which could be evolving into pseudocysts or becoming infected, to fully declare themselves. The CT is the best test to visualize these complications, which are likely the reason he's not getting better, and might require specific interventions like drainage or antibiotics if infected.
Makes sense. You're looking for the reason he's not improving. Last one, branching scenario three. Thinking back to his initial presentation, the abrupt onset of pain right after a large fatty meal, what's the single most likely underlying cause or etiology of his acute pancreatitis?
Given that specific trigger sudden pain after a fatty meal, the most likely initial etiology is gallstone pancreatitis. It's the most common cause overall, and that particular presentation is very characteristic of a stone passing and transiently obstructing the pancreatic duct.
Perfect. All right, team, get ready for the memory blast recap. Listen up. Acute pancreatitis. It's inflammation of the pancreas. Diagnose it with 2 out of 3. PLI, characteristic pain, lipase amylase, 3X ULN imaging findings.
Lipase is your go-to lab, especially if they present late or have alcohol use history. And please stop the daily enzyme checks once you've made the diagnosis. It doesn't help.
Spotting Cullen's or Gray Turner sign. Rare, but it screams severe necrotizing pancreatitis, probably with bleeding. Huge red flag.
Need to assess for necrosis or complications. Get a CT, but wait at least 3 days after onset for the best look. MRI is your friend for early diagnosis, kidney problems, pregnancy, or checking the ducts.
And always, always keep your differential broad for abdominal pain. Rule out those dangerous mimics before settling on pancreatitis. Fantastic. All right, residents, you have just crushed this deep dive on acute pancreatitis. You've gone from the basics through ward pearls right into diagnostic dilemmas. Now here's your mission. Hit the wards tomorrow armed with at least one new tip you learned today. Quiz yourself on that PLI mnemonic tonight. And hey, DM us your own clutch pancreatitis moments or even those epic fails we learned from both at 88 Diagnoses. Stay sharp, stay curious, and keep dominating your game.